If I tune it for 3700 and I go to 3750, I'm going to have to readjust the antenna tuner. It's going to be narrowband, but at the frequency it's resonated and properly tuned. That very, very small physical dipole with helical winding will be within half a dB of the exact same gain and beam width and gain and effective capture area of the full 132-foot long dipole. That's the so-called infinitesimal dipole. There's a specific chapter in the antenna, in the book by Krauss called Antennas. An infinitesimal dipole built out of efficient materials, properly resonated, gives you within half a dB the exact same gain. And the half a dB of decrease is not a real decrease in gain. It's got a slightly fatter dipole, a donut pattern. It's a fatter pattern, that's where the half dB went. It's not half a dB of inefficiency. So once...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So once you're willing to build your antenna, physically small, but properly re-resonated electronically, by comparison to a full half-wave dipole, essentially all of the performance comes back. Gain on transmission, gain on reception, effective capture area. The only thing you lose when you make it physically small is it goes high in Q and becomes narrow band. Narrow band really means that as you QSY, you've got to do a hell of a lot more retuning when you change frequency than you would with a full size dipole, but other than that, you get full performance. You'd be amazed how many people will challenge you when you say those words. But believe it or not, those words, in my opinion, are traceable to the Bureau, traceable back to the Bible of antenna engineering, Krauss's book and antennas, edition number one. And I'm pretty sure those chapters also appeared in edition number two and three. Let's go on to the next question that John's got. KC2WGB, K2LIW. Go ahead, John.
Very good, Nick. Yeah, that's good information. I'm sure he can work with that. He knows where the minefield is. Very good. Okay, next question is a gentleman who has a signal generator, RF signal generator. It's from 50 to 500 meg. It's a polar, nice little generator, kind of expensive. But he has found leakage to be a problem when he's making low-level measurements. And he has taken the cabinet apart, made sure all the finger stock, all the screws, and all the shields are in place, and it has excessive leakage. Well, he traced it down with a little sniffer, and it's coming out of the RF millivoltmeter. That's where he's finding it. He'd like to know if there would be any problem with putting maybe a copper box or an aluminum box on that meter on the inside to shield it, to prevent that radiation from coming out. And how do you think you should go about it? And I have a word. I'll see what you cover, and maybe I have something also. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Hey, John, this is a classic problem. And yes, by way of your sniffer, a spectrum analyzer, and whatever, you think the leakage is coming from the RF millivoltmeter. Maybe it is, maybe it is not. And even if that was, by the way, when a good electromagnetic compatibility engineer, electromagnetic interference engineer, is looking for the leakage of a product, his usual way of wording it, if he's got experience, is, what's the tallest pole in the tent? You find out, if you're failing the spec, what's the tallest pole? And you address that one, and you'll rapidly find out there are three or four more others. It's a whole bunch of snakes in the grass, so to speak. Even though you knock down the big one, the next one may be only 3 dB weaker. You knock that down, and the next one may be only 5 dB weaker than the big one. When it comes to leakage, everything has a large number of leakages. Only thing left to discuss is how strong each one is. So I'm a little bit afraid that if he goes down the road thinking that his problem will go away because he's found the tallest pole in the tent and he thinks there's no other poles. Let me drop.
I have a little added information.
In a minute, I'm going to take your added information, but I'm going to follow through with this one. You take the classic signal generator, Hewlett-Packard 608, way back in the 1960 time frame. In its day, it was a Cadillac. It goes from 10 megs to 480 megs. and it's got a dial in the front panel that can give you plus 5 dBm all the way down to minus 110, minus 115. And if you're trying to test a signal, make a weak signal for a receiver, you've got a receiver that has a sensitivity of minus 130, and a lot of them do, and the dial on the front panel only goes down to a minus 115. You say, well, I'll just add a 15 dB pad. You do that, you're going to get a rude awakening. The rude awakening is because there really is a, let me pick a number, 50 milliwatt oscillator inside that box. 50 milliwatts is plus 17 dBm. You're trying to get down to minus 130. You're asking for close to 150 decibels of shielding. You can't get there from here without heroic approach, which would be making the product extremely expensive. So when you're trying to test a signal of minus 130 on a signal generator like that one, there's only one solution that I know of. If you can't get a different signal generator that's specifically made for the minus 130, and they're rare, that's the so-called New England approach. Let me drop. You recognize the fact that no matter what you do, no matter how careful you shield that cabinet, some leakage is always going to be coming out of there. Remember what I've said so many times. Once you create a radio wave, it goes to every cubic centimeter of this universe. And I'm not kidding. You can't stop it from doing that. It bounces off of everything. It filters through everything. You create a radio wave, it goes everywhere. The only thing left to discuss is how strong is it when it gets there? Is it above the threshold of the equipment you're using at this time? You take this $60 million signal anechoic chamber built at Edwards Air Force Base, and I worked there for a period of time. Spent $60 million building the world's best anechoic chamber. This thing had quarter-inch thick steel walls everywhere with beautiful welds on all of those sheets of metal, and the welds were all tested for their integrity. They thought they had a chamber that nothing could leak out or leak in. Well, they had a chamber that had 100 dB of shielding, but if there's a broadcast station outside nearby, which starts off 120 dB above threshold, you go inside that chamber, close the door, and you're still going to hear that signal. So the word shielding is a relative word. The word quiet is a relative word. So what do the guys in New England do? You're going to test the receiver that goes to minus 130. You know the signal is leaking out of the cabinet. But the leakage out of the cabinet is like every other antenna. It's a transmitting device. It must obey the inverse square law. Every time you double the distance, you get half the amount of signal. They put the signal generator in the backyard, run a long piece of cable of known attenuation of the cable, because they calibrated it, bring the cable from the backyard into the laboratory, and connect.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
They bring that cable into the receiver, into the laboratory, and connect it to the receiver. The cabinet is still leaking, but the cabinet is leaking so far away in the backyard that it no longer affects the receiver they're testing. And yeah, you got to get the guy on the telephone or a handy talkie in the backyard and tell him to turn the signal generator up and down and change the frequency. You got to remotely control that signal generator in the backyard. And if you're real smart, you do it by a computer network. So you can get around the problem of the cabinet leaking. For you to think you're going to make perfect shielding, no way in hell. I'll admit that if you're really smart, you can take a known product and knock down the tall pole in the tent, so to speak, another 10, 15 dB. But if you think you're going to make perfect shielding, I'm going to sell you a bridge in Brooklyn. I own a piece of it. John owns some of it also. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I think I got a few more shares in that bridge than you do. Okay, the added information was, and what shocks me is, this is an excellent generator. They make great stuff. The generator has a plastic meter in it, which is normally usually a metal meter and shielded. It's not. So what he did was, he made a little cover that he put over the front of the meter, and he got good enough attenuation where he could do his work, but of course he can't see the meter. So that's why he was wondering about a box in the back. So exactly what you said, yes, he could put it far away and do all of that, and I don't think he's measuring down to those sensitivities. where he's picking up the extraneous. I think there's a problem. Maybe the meter was subbed or something's wrong. But he did detect a good reduction in the signal by putting a cover over the meter grounded to the case.
WHYY. Okay, he's definitely made an improvement. And maybe he's made enough decibels improvement for his situation. Get to you in a second, Joe. However, when the leakage from the cabinet, when you've added the extra shielding, and you think it's not affecting your measurement, you got to be careful. Because even if the signal leaking from the cabinet going into your receiver is 10 decibels below the sensitivity of the receiver, and common sense would lead you to believe it's not there. It is there. You give me a signal 10 dB into the noise, and you allow me to use radio astronomy, what they call radiometry techniques. I forget the exact number, but depending on whether or not the situation is a coherent situation where you're measuring phase as well as amplitude, 10 dB below the noise could give you, I'm not sure of the exact number, it could give you 1.5 decibels of error in the measurement you've made, because that signal that you think is below threshold is adding to the real signal, and they're adding in a vector manner that might be cophase or antiphase. So if you really want the leakage of the receiver not to be affecting the careful measurements you're making, you would like the leakage out of the cabinet to be, let me pick a number, 25 or 30 decibels weaker than the sensitivity of the receiver. It's very similar to what's going on when you build a good anechoic chamber. Let me drop. You build an anechoic chamber for two reasons. One, you're shielding it from the outside world, the measurements you're making. And two, you want them to have, between the transmitting antenna and the antenna on the test, you want to have one single path and no reflections off the walls and the ceiling and the floor, because the reflections interfere with the accuracy of the pattern and the gain and everything else that you're measuring. You want the echo off the wall to be, let me pick a number, 40 decibels down. If the echo off the wall is 25 dB down, when you're measuring an antenna pattern, the gain that you measure will be in the vicinity of half a dB of error just due to that term alone. You want the error, you want the undesired product to be 30 or 40 dB weaker than the measurement you're making, whether it be a signal generator into a receiver, whether it be the echo off the wall of an anechoic chamber. Opposite of common sense, I know. Over to you, Joe, to B2RYY, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Good evening again, Dick, W2RYY. When John mentioned about the guy having this signal generator with a plastic meter where it normally may have had metal in there, that may have been a substitution, the leakage may be coming from actually inside the unit behind the meter, and the plastic is just simply letting it through the front panel, however this thing is constructed. What this guy might want to do is try testing his generator again with the case removed from the generator, and he might actually find that some hot spots within the generator construction itself that maybe it's leaking from, like you said, the tallest pole of the tent.
Yeah, I'm going to add something else here. There's a slim possibility that the original Dawson Val movement meter on the front panel of that signal generator was a metal cased meter. It failed and somebody substituted it with a plastic case meter, which is now leaking. Once you realize the mechanism of the leakage, the signal, RF signal, is coming through that hole in the cabinet, which is a small piece of waveguide beyond cutoff, as they say, you don't have to do the shielding on the outside. You can do the shielding on the inside. The original metal case meter really was a metal cup-shaped object with a meter movement inside. He could build a shield, which is a metal cup that goes behind the cabinet, behind the meter, with two holes going through that cup that goes into the actual meter movement itself. And if he's really careful, those two feed-through holes will have a bypass capacitor on them, a feed-through capacitor of, let me pick a number, 5,000 picofarads, feed-through capacitor, so that no RF energy can go through that wiring, through the cup, metal cup on the inside, into his plastic meter movement, which has got the nice scale on it that he likes. So there's multiple solutions here. But once you realize what you're doing with what's going on is you're going to make some number of decibels of improvement. You can never stop the undesired leakage out of any signal generator. Depending on how much heroic you use, you can take each of those tall poles in the tent and knock them down by some number of decibels. You'll never make them all go to zero. You have to realize that ahead of time, otherwise you might end up chasing your tail for a long time if you don't realize what you're really working with, so to speak. The magic of radio, it goes everywhere. That allows you to communicate with, let me drop it. That Voyager spacecraft is out there, 120 astronomical units, something like 80 billion miles. And we're still talking to that thing that was launched in 1976. It's the longest range piece of hardware that mankind has ever created. You may be amazed how many arguments I've got into with people saying that, hey, the radio wave, when it goes that far, it's going to get tired. Uh-uh. It just keeps falling off 6 dB per octave every time you double the distance between you and it. That radio wave never gets tired. It's not human. It goes everywhere. The signals they're getting from Voyager today, they would not have been able to do in 1976 when they launched that spacecraft. Since then, the Goldstone dish, the Mars 14 installation in the Mojave Desert of Fort Irwin, and I've been there. That dish, they've increased the diameter of the dish, they've put more sensitive parametric amplifiers on it, they've increased the sensitivity of that system. That system has grown in the last 40 years since they launched, the last 35, 40 years, since they launched that spacecraft, and they can continue to talk to it. And because of the improvements they've made in their ground station, I think they're going to be able to talk to it for another 10 years. Over to you, John, KC2WGV, K2RW. By the way, I'm going to check that with Paul when we get to him. You got it, John.
Just a quick comment on what you just said, or actually a question. If they can improve the sensitivity of the receiving equipment on Earth, what do you do about the other end? It's only so sensitive.
Good question. When they made those improvements, they made the area of the dish greater by increasing the perimeter of the dish. They made the receiver more sensitive by using a better cryogenically cooled receiver. They put in a stronger... First of all, as they increased the diameter of the dish, the gain of the dish on transmitting went up, and they increased the power output of the transmitter. And if that wasn't enough, they also can use very long baseline interferometry techniques. Goldstone has got not one dish, but three dishes in Australia and Spain and in California. And at least during certain portions of the day as the Earth rotates, you can aim more than one dish at that satellite simultaneously and combine the signal from the two receiving sites. You can do the same thing on transmit if you're smart enough. You can transmit from two sites and get twice as much transmitting gain. They got a couple of other tricks up their sleeve they haven't even used yet, Joe, as you can see. There's no limit to this. You give me more and more antennas, you allow me to combine them, I'll get you more and more gain. W2RYY for a comment, K2RIW.
I don't have a comment, I just find the whole thing fascinating, but aren't you going to eventually get to a point where the thing only receives so much from so far away?
Are you telling me the signal that you transmit is going to get tired? Now, you give me enough transmitting area of the transmitting antennas, you give me enough power output in watts from the transmitter, and I can talk to that extraterrestrial that's a long distance away, if you know what I mean, Joe. Over to you, Joe.
I just meant as far as the capability of the receiver on the spacecraft itself. It's only made so sensitive, and it only works to such a certain level, it only has a certain noise figure, I would receive so far down into the noise, or whatever threshold it has way out there 80 billion miles away. That's all I was asking, that's all.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Joe. There is a kind of a limit. But because the technology is improving, we haven't come close to that limit yet. I think when it comes to the uplink, I am guessing they've got at least 6 dB of margin. They're already out there at 120 astronomical units. They're three times the distance of Pluto out there right now. My gut feel is they can double that distance and still talk to that thing. as such, I think they're, as long as the electronics hangs in there and the nuclear power supply hangs in there and the traveling wave tube hangs in there, I think the capability is that they can talk to that thing for another 20 years. That's a guess. We're going to ask Paul if he's got a comment on that when we get to him. John, see if you got another question. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Well, Dick, we brought up an interesting point about this Goldhart generator. He might just simply have a bad bypass capacitor or something like that on the meter. The meter looks like an OEM product. I don't know for sure, but I'm usually looking at metal meters on those machines. So he could have that. And yeah, that's what he wanted to do, is build a little box or a cage and put it on the back of the meter. But I think he should also check the decoupling on the leads itself.
I'm going to agree with you there, John. And so, yes, the meter itself could be a kind of a miniature antenna. If the signal going to, if the RF signal is getting to the meter when the meter is intended to measure a DC current. So there's lots of other things that can be checked. There's a lot of solutions to that problem. I didn't say they're easy, but there's a lot of possible solutions. But the bottom line eventually is what's called the New England technique. Put the signal generator at a remote distance. They literally used to put it in the backyard and shout to the guy who's turning the dials in order to make a receiver sensitivity measurement. It's a little bit hokey, but it works. Go ahead with your next question, John, K2LIW.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. I've put my generators in the driveway sometimes and brought the leads into the shop because that can be very annoying. But it's also late. I think we should go to Paul because I know you want to talk to Glenn about that subject also, so maybe we should go over to Paul. KC2WGB.
Okay, I see if Paul's available. WS2N, what has NASA been doing? I hear tell that there was a kind of an announcement about the Curiosity, the Mars Science Laboratory. This roughly one-ton Volkswagen-sized thing that's roving around Mars. I think they're finding stronger and stronger evidence of water and or the raw ingredients that could have formed life. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, Dick, very good. This is WS2N. Curiosity, yeah, well, they just drilled into their first rock. First time they did this with any of the robotic equipment. Oh, they've had things to brush off rocks and, you know, take like the, you might call the rind off, the, off of a rock. But this thing drilled right into a rock. And they brought a number of drill bits up with them. And it's successfully it's done a little over a half inch in diameter, about 2 inches deep. Going to take the dust from that thing, it collects in the bit, and they're going to put the dust into the scoop, take pictures. From the scoop, it'll go into the Kenman experiment in the body of the Curiosity, and run some tests. This will help confirm another water theory. So that's the story on that. And you had a question about Voyager 1. What was it? I mean, the last time I checked, it was 123 AU out. Was that the question?
That's sort of the question. I am speculating that as NASA made improvements in the deep space network, where they increased the diameter of the 240-foot diameter dish at Goldstone, California, they increased its diameter, increased the antenna gain. They made improvements when it comes to the feed horn assembly. They made it into a beam waveguide, which means the equivalent of the transmission line that goes between the transmitter and receiver and the feed horn of the dish. They went to a technique called a beam waveguide, which has lower loss, and they put on more sensitive receivers, so, and probably better transmitters. So they're continuously improving the system. More gain, more transmit power, more receiver sensitivity. And so the current sensitivity they're getting, they didn't have that in 1976 during the launch of Voyager. And I'm not convinced that they would have had good communication with Voyager by the 1976 technology. And the question that various people have asked is, what about the uplink? In other words, when you're talking to Voyager and you're commanding it to do something, to make a measurement for you, As it gets further and further away, and that signal going on the uplink to Voyager gets weaker and weaker, I guess it was Joe and other people are speculating that eventually we're not going to be able to talk to the thing. It's out of range, if you know what I mean. I think they've got at least 60 meters of fade margin on the uplink today, and I think they can talk to it for a long time in the future. Slowly. I mean, as you make the downlink work slower and slower, your receiver on the ground can listen to a weaker and weaker signal. And I think there's a somewhat similar technique being used on the uplink by the way they reconfigure the spacecraft itself. So if you happen to know anything about the uplink sensitivity, in other words, are we getting close to the point where it's becoming difficult to talk to it and it can understand what you're saying? WS2N, KQLIW.
What I know is that the receiver sensitivity was so good that, I don't know, it probably would have been able to receive, maybe with the older system that we had. It's a transmitting problem. I think they're probably down to probably no more than 25 watts, I think. It was Ed Stone, he was in charge of the whole operation. He was interviewed a few years back and said it was 25 watts. Probably less than that, more traveling wave tube things, and that will probably would probably be the problem. But they've increased the sensitivity so much that even I don't think that's the problem. One of Carl Sagan's older books before he died back in '96 stated that we'll probably lose contact around 2015 with the Voyagers. But, you know, there's been a lot of upgrades. They predicted to go for another maybe at least 5 or 10 years before they have a problem. And power won't be it. Let me drop it.
Yeah, let me interrupt you for a second, Paul. Even if the traveling wave tube on Voyager, which is transmitting the downlink, even if that, you say, 25-watt tube is down to, let me pick a number, 13 watts, the downlink is getting weaker. And the spacecraft is getting further away. But because of the coherence of that system and the way they can tell it, okay, the signal is getting weak here on the ground in the downlink, and you command the spacecraft to transmit the data slower, less bits per second, therefore you can set the noise equivalent bandwidth of the downlink receiver to be more narrow. As long as you get less bits, I mean, if you transmit 50 bits per second, in theory, you can make the receiver something like 50 hertz wide, and as such, it can listen to a very weak signal. And if the downlink transmitter gets weaker, you tell it transmit 25 bits per second instead of 50 bits per second, and you pick up another 3 decibels of sensitivity, in theory. So, downlink sensitivity, they got lots of ways to go. What Joe is worrying about is the uplink. The transmitter at Goldstone has, let me pick a number, 10,000 watts of output into a antenna of, let me pick a number, 50 decibels of gain. That signal has to go out there 123 astronomical units, and when that uplink signal gets to Voyager, Voyager has to be able to interpret the uplink and figure out what is NASA's command to Voyager today. So we're a little worried about the uplink sensitivity to command Voyager. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, I have a question if you...
Okay, Dick, I know the it was built with a lot of ability to change things inside there, inside the equipment. Maybe they've slowed down the ability to... the bit rate, you know, on a receive mode. I don't know if that's been done. But I've never read that that's going to be a problem. The problem that they're going to have for failure has always been the thermocouple system actually failing, or maybe the electronics. But, you know, you've got the radioisotope thermal electric generator on board that might eventually lead to a problem. Because that feeds the thermocouples, and the similar metal thing. That they think that might be the failure point, and you're going to lose power eventually. Although they've cut a lot of equipment out, they don't need a camera anymore. That's all gone. They just have the essentials: the radio and magnetometer and a thing that detects the cosmic winds. Let me drop it. They've changed the bit rate to receive. I don't know. I've never read a problem that they thought it would be a failure because of transmitting or receiving. So I don't know. I guess it could be a problem. But they've increased everything on, you know, you've got the Deep Space Network, three of them, Goldstone, Canberra, and Madrid. They increased that stuff, not just because of that. These antennas are used for all the deep space communications, including the newest one that's really going to be active, the Rosetta program, that one that's going to land on a comet. So they've got a lot of reasons for increasing the strength of these things. By the way, in the beginning, everybody's talking about how many inches of snow you got to wind up with. 28, I measure it, averages out around different locations. It comes out to about 28 in Ronkonkoma. And with no clouds coming through, you see that on the news. You know, we're one of those people. Back to you, Dick.
Question. Okay, 28 inches out there in Ronkonkoma. I know that the biggest number was, I think, 35 inches in Medford, which is not too far from you. Wes, what is your question? I guess it's with reference to Voyager. Into XJN, K2LIW.
Yes, it is. Communication. We're briefly touching the antenna length, the antenna diameter, and antenna performance. And thank you for that comment. But now, based on the Newton's law, body put in motion, stay in motion. And energy can be converted to mass and reverse. But there's two tokens. There should be no losses for the energy that is in space traveling through space at given direction. And here's it.
Energy in space, traveling in space, has a particular direction. Okay? What I think you're saying is that you have to make sure that I think it's approximately a 10-foot diameter parabolic dish antenna operating on X-band that's on Voyager. You have to make sure that Voyager has its positioning system working correctly so it's capable of continuously aiming that dish at Earth. If for any reason Voyager loses orientation and doesn't aim that dish at Earth, and that beautiful, when they pick a number, 40 decibels of gain goes away because that pencil beam is not aimed at Earth. If it's aimed at, let me pick a number, Jupiter instead of Earth, you're off the air. That communication link is broken. It's game over. What Paul is worried about is that the thermoelectric generator, the nuclear thermoelectric generator, which runs with the heat being generated by that radioactive source, is picked up by these thermocouples, converted into electrical energy. And some people are a little worried about those individual elements have a finite life. I'm not talking about the radioactive material. The rate of decay of the radioactive material, that's predictable. Will those thermocouples hang in there? Will the traveling wave tubing hang in there? And even if it's got 25 watts output in the beginning and is down to 13 watts today, that, to me, is not a showstopper. That just slows down the rate at which you can communicate with it in the downlink. And we're not quite sure how much margin is left in the uplink, the ability to command it. And here we are, let me think, 1976, that's 35 or so, 37 years downrange. I'm amazed that the spacecraft continues to orient itself. It has to aim that dish to, let me...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
That Voyager has to make sure that that pencil beam, very narrow beam width antenna, probably has a quarter of a degree of beam width. That's got to be aimed at Earth to the nearest plus or minus a tenth of a degree if you're going to continue to communicate with us correctly. Because a lot of things got to work just right for this thing to work. But the signal itself going through space, as long as the dish on Voyager is properly aimed, as long as the transmitter has some reasonable amount of power output in the vicinities of the numbers we're talking about, as long as we can command the uplink to tell it how fast we want it to talk in bits per second, I see no reason why we can't continue to talk to that thing for at least 10 more years. Now, in the case of Curiosity, let me drop.
K2WILE.
Bernie, get you in a second. One of the things that NASA would love to be able to do is to send a spacecraft to Mars, scoop up a carefully selected piece of material off of Mars, and fly it back home in order to test it in a laboratory. That's the way they word it today. I think it's a better way of wording it. What equipment are you going to use in that laboratory? If you're smart enough, why can't you put that equipment on Voyager and let it fly that equipment to Mars, scoop up that piece of material, and do that test for you and report the results? To fly the piece of material back home is so darn much more difficult. So I think there's a better approach. K2YO, go ahead, Bernie. K2RIW.
Excuse me, Dick. I don't want to take the conversation too much astray, but I'm curious, how does the spacecraft align its high-gain antenna back to Earth? You're talking about a fairly precise alignment process. How does it know where it is, and how does it know where we are? And if this is too far off subject, just move on, but I'm just curious about that.
Do you have any comment on that?
Hey, don't be so humble, as I see it, Bernie. That's a darn good question. The spacecraft, almost all of the spacecraft, have what they call alignment stars. In other words, there are certain fixed stars. Whether you and I sit on Earth and we look at, let me pick a number, a star, Polaris, Sirius, Rigel, Altar, you choose any of the stars, Arcturus, any of the stars that you think are major stars that you see in the sky at Earth. Those stars, in general, are so far away from us, and you think that Voyager is out there a long distance. Those stars at Voyager look almost identical to the way they do on Earth. And so that telescope-like structure looks at those stars, knows exactly where true north is. I'm just using that as a true north and true east. And those are very relative words when it comes to a spacecraft. And where is the Earth going to be? Everything here is deterministic. For the next zillions of years, every minute of every day, of every hour, of every year, you know exactly where the Earth is going to be, where the Moon is going to be. You therefore can tell Voyager how to aim once he has found those alignment stars. So the main thing that Voyager is doing is what you and I would call the scientific equivalent of stargazing. It's using those alignment stars. That's the only thing it's got is an absolute. You can't use a compass, a magnetometer. You can't use local gravity. The only thing that we on Earth have in common with Voyager are those so-called fixed stars. You choose the right star.
Repeater, time out.
You choose the right stars. They appear to never move. Let me turn it back to Bernie first. K2IO, does that make some sense? K2LIW?
Well, absolutely. I guess, and once it has those stars, it doesn't do any radical revolutionary movements, meaning it doesn't heavily rotate or anything, so those stars more or less stay in the same place. If we could reach out with a giant hand and spin the spacecraft like a top, would it be able to find those stars again?
WS2N.
Yeah, I'm going to turn it over to Paul for that one. Periodically, every one of these spacecraft will occasionally lose lock. Something goes wrong. a gas jet doesn't work quite right, and there's a whole procedure for reacquisition of those stars. So there's a built-in computer program that if it loses those stars, it goes through a very specific acquisition process to refind those alignment stars. Paul, first on that, this question, WS2N, K2LIW.
I've changed the attitude of Voyager a number of times, so they'll change the location of it because they'll want to get different readings from the solar winds, either the galactic winds coming in or the relationship to the solar winds, and then it will change back to look at Earth. They always use the star tracking. They call them star tracking instruments on board all those spacecraft. So that's how, and it's not so much of a fuel issue. It still has fuel on board. They use these gyros. They'll spin them up and through a precession, it'll actually move the spacecraft. They got plenty of time to do this, so it takes. They don't need an instant change. So if they move the spacecraft, it'll sit there for a week. Then they'll move it back. It might take a couple of days to get back to where it's supposed to be. And then they'll lock on the signal. So I think there's a signal lock also. The stronger the signal, that helps them. It's everything tied into the computer with the star tracker. Back to you, Nick.
Yeah, almost all of these spacecraft are using some number of stars to do the alignment, and there's a whole acquisition procedure for if they lose lock on those stars to reacquire. And so if I understand correctly from Paul, what Paul is saying is that some of the commands given to Voyager were, okay, don't look at Earth for the next few hours or few days. Aim the antenna, aim your instrumentation in this particular direction. Tell me what the solar wind looks like. And then when you finish making that measurement and you make those recordings, come back to this alignment, aim the dish at Earth, and talk to us. Now, when it comes to some of the satellites that we put into orbit, occasionally we use gyroscopic spin stability techniques. Voyager is not doing that. It is not spinning. It is, to my knowledge, if you and I could stare at Voyager for the next week, except for a command where you tell it to look somewhere else, it is always the exact same orientation, up, down, left, right, and the way it aims at that dish at Earth. I'm picking a number to the nearest tenth of a degree of accuracy. And if it doesn't do that, you lose communication. That's a... Even when the astronauts... Let me drop... I'll show you something else that is crazy. When the astronauts went to the moon on the Apollo program, Apollo 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, 17, the only real communication connection they had with all of humanity was that radio beam. If the electronics on that downlink and uplink transmitter on Apollo failed, that's it, as far as communication goes. You'd like to say, well, we'll just aim the Palomar telescope at Apollo, and we'll figure out what's going on. Mm-mm. You'd be amazed how small a target that is. You get so little resolution. If you aimed Palomar at Apollo when it's in lunar orbit, and the sun is shining on Apollo, you'll see a little white dot of reflection. You'll know that an object is there. You'd like to be able to believe that you could look at Apollo and say, hey, it's upside down, and I see somebody in the window waving at me. Absolutely not. You would just barely tell that there's an object there when the sun glints off it just right. If that radio beam fails, you ain't talking to the Earth anymore. All of humanity just got cut off from you. It's a very sobering thought. That's part of the reason why they had so darn many backups of VHF, UHF on those radios. That's the only connection you got with all of humanity at that time. Go ahead, Wes, with your question. WS2N, K2LAW.
I'm W2TTT.
We hear you, Gordon. you up in a minute. Go ahead, Wes.
Can't touch you. Well, there is a different story with looking at the spacecraft from the Earth, looking from the spacecraft to the Earth. The farther the spacecraft is, the easier for the spacecraft to orient itself. The angle of incidence at 4 degrees, if you treat it as a triangle of probability, the further it is, the wider diameter of the angle covered, it is down there. So there would be a time when the spacecraft starts, when that third arm of the triangle would be as big as the United States, but then would be as big as the Earth, and then would be as big as the solar system. You know what I'm saying? So just redirect from the spacecraft to the Earth is how much we're losing, because we still have two wide antenna. Interesting.
Hey, you've fallen into a trap, Wes. You've used good common sense, and it will fail you. Let's assume that Voyager was sitting at the distance of Pluto, and let's assume it's got a quarter of a degree beamwidth antenna. And yes, a quarter of a degree beamwidth antenna covers a certain amount of real estate in the vicinity of the Earth. And if you change the orientation of the antenna on Voyager, you steer it, if it was a quarter of a degree antenna and I steer it 1 1/8 degrees off to one side, I am 3 decibels down in signal that I receive or transmit. I'm sitting at Pluto. I now go twice the distance of Pluto. And yes, that same quarter of a degree beam without an antenna is covering twice as much real estate in the vicinity of Earth. It's lighting up a bigger chunk of real estate. That's the good news. However, you steer that dish at twice the distance of Pluto, again 1 1/8 degrees off to one side, you are again 3 dB down. It's the exact same antenna pattern. You look at that antenna pattern as a polar plot, as an XY plot, any plot you want. The horizontal axis is steering in azimuth or elevation. The vertical axis is gain. You go 1 1/8 degrees off of the peak of that beam, you're 3 dB down. It doesn't matter if you're at the Pluto distance, twice the Pluto distance, or 3 times the Pluto distance. You go 1 1/8 degrees off to one side, the signal you get is 3 dB weaker. You better aim it accurately or you're not going to talk to the Earth. Gordon, W2TTT, K2RIW, go ahead.
Yeah, just reminding me of that David Bowie song, you know, Major Tom, your circuit's dead, there's something wrong, can you hear me, Major Tom?
Okay, you were there 50% of the time, Gordon. Can you hear me there, Major Tom? I think you're talking about a particular science fiction television program or a movie. Not quite sure. I want to try again, here we go. Gordon, W2, Tango, 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 K2RIW.
Song from the 70s.
Okay, something from the 70s. All right, you were talking about a song, a television program, a movie, I'm not quite sure what. Unfortunately, we're only getting 50% of the copy with your current location, Gordon. Let's see if Glenn is available. KC2QIQ. Glenn, if you are, we're going to pick your brain a little bit. KC2QIQ, are you there? K2LIW?
Just talking about a song, by the way, Dick.
Yeah, Dick, you're not up on your music. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, part of what's going on here, Glenn, is I'm not part of the society. I just look in on it periodically. When it comes to modern music, I'm way out there. People talk about some of the movies and movie music and whatever, and who's the best football player, and who's the best basketball player, and who's the best baseball player. they think I'm disconnected from all of this. As we left last week, Glenn, you also apparently have been enthralled with the measurements that were done by Maynard Hill of Applied Physics Laboratory. Started off with my first exposure was a Flying Model magazine way back in 1972, I think it was, in which, in theory, you take this wooden yardstick, you take a polonium source on each end of the yardstick, you connect it with wires to a operational amplifier or the equivalent, and you measure the electrostatic difference of the Earth's ionosphere. In other words, the ionosphere is a layer of plasma, call it a conductor, that's what a plasma is, it is electronically a conductor. It's something in the vicinity of 50 kilometers above the Earth, and because of ultraviolet exposure, solar wind exposure, whatever, for a whole bunch of crazy reasons, that plasma is around, I think it's a third of a million volts positive with reference to Earth. Earth is the ground, so to speak. And in between the two, if you take the 50 kilometers and the third of a million volts, I forget what the exact number is, but it's probably something in the vicinity of 1 or 2 volts per meter. So you take this meter stick, and you displace these two polonium sources, and you will measure that voltage. And you're familiar with that experiment, and me and Mario Di Diego at Airborne Instrument Laboratory, way back in 1972, we duplicated that experiment. We built...
Repeater, time out.
We built that thing, we saw that measurement. And so, first of all, are you up to speed on that one? I wonder if you built something, or at least you read those articles and were similarly enthralled, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Dick, I'll take 20 seconds.
I am familiar with the experiment, Dick. Probably not as well as you are, but yes, I definitely have read it, and I think I understand it pretty well. But here again, continue. KC2QIQ.
Okay, I just heard Paul, WS2N, said you wanted to say something, Paul. Go right ahead.
That mission is being launched from orbital from Vandenberg Air Force Base on an Atlas rocket, big rocket, and then that'll be in polar orbit. So tomorrow, around 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, around a little after 10 o'clock on Pacific Standard Time, you'll probably catch it on the web. I don't think it'll be televised, but it's an ongoing program. It'll be called Landsat 8 after it's in orbit, after testing it for about 3 months. So it's a nice replacement for the older one that's failing. It's been up there for like 40 years, 40 years. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
Very good, Paul. So another good launch is going to take place tomorrow from Vandenberg, a near polar orbit. Okay, so getting back to the Maynard Hill experiment, he recognized the fact that as long as there isn't a nearby grounded object like a tree or a building, as long as there isn't a thunderstorm taking place, this gradient of voltage, the number of volts per meter between the ionosphere and the Earth, is a very predictable thing. He therefore built a radio-controlled model airplane with this huge stability chunk of electronics, very simple chunk of electronics, by putting a polonium source on the right wing tip and the left wing tip of the airplane, comparing the voltage between the two, you know whether or not the airplane is rolled to the right or the left and how much. And similarly, you put another polonium source on the nose and on the tail, you know whether or not the airplane is pitched up or pitched down. And he did a number of experiments where he was flying the airplane manually, and he had a telemetry feedback or a recording system, and you could see the airplane wobbling around a little bit, yaw, pitch, and roll. He turns on the stability system, let the electronics take over, and the thing flies very straight and level. And so that's one of a number of experiments that he did. He also recently flew a computer-controlled airplane that flew from Newfoundland all the way over to Ireland. He did that a few years ago and collected a very nice prize. Okay. In the case of establishing an electrostatic field, an electric field, you have an upper conductor, a lower conductor, and the number of volts between the two or a certain amount of charge between the two. You and I have also done something similar along these lines. Let me grab. And that is, whenever you're testing a handheld device, you and I tend to put them into a laboratory piece of equipment called a GTEM. The GTEM really is this huge feed horn-like device, which literally has an upper conductor, a lower conductor, and we put a known number of volts between the two, and then the number of volts between the two could be steady state, it could be RF at a particular frequency, and you set up some number of volts per meter to measure the electronic susceptibility, the radio susceptibility of the handheld product. A good handheld product, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, can tolerate 10 volts per meter at 100 megacycles without interrupting its performance. And similarly, you can also use the GTEM in the other way around to find out what are the radiated emission of your device in the test. You put your device in the test into this GTEM, and as it emits a signal across the frequencies that you scan, 10 megs to 1,000 megs, you find out how many volts per meter it radiates on each of those frequencies. So you're probably somewhat familiar with that GTEM device. Is that true, Glenn? KCQQIQ, K2LIW?
Spent many, many hours around one, Vic. Especially went over at Dayton G. Brown, KCQQIQ.
Awful glad to hear that. Now you and I are on the same page. So notice that in an RF field of a GTEM, where you test the susceptibility of a chunk of electronics, or the emissions, the undesired emissions of a device on the test in the GTEM, where you measure how many volts per meter comes back out of your device on the test, take a look at what we've always done. There is the equivalent in the GTEM, in the Earth's ionosphere, whatever. You always have an upper conductor, a lower conductor, a known distance between the two, a known voltage between the two, or a known charge between the two, which are really the same thing. So to set up either a dynamic or static electronic field, electric field, by those pieces of experience seems to require two conductors, some space. The space could be vacuum, air, dielectric material. You readjust things accordingly, but you still need upper conductor, lower conductor distance, voltage, and charge. And here we are with something called an electromagnetic wave. We say that it has a magnetic component and an electrical component, an E and an H component. I accept the H component, the magnetic component. But when it comes to the E component, we don't have a clearly defined upper conductor and lower conductor. We don't have a clearly defined space between those conductors that don't exist. All we have is Faraday's law. We know that if I emit a horizontally polarized magnetic field, H field is horizontal, and I set up a vertical piece of wire by way of Maxwell's, Faraday's law, we know that the wire will have induced into it.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The wire will have induced into it a certain number of volts, call it volts per meter, depending on the rate of change of the magnetic field. That's Faraday's law, and that's what happens. Now, I'm proposing two crazy-sounding thought experiments, which at first I'm not going to make sense, but we'll dig into it a little bit. The first experiment, instead of setting up a vertically polarized piece of wire to measure the apparent E field and H field, I could set up a upper and lower polonium source. I could do the RF equivalent of what Maynard Hill did when he made the static electric field measurement. As long as my frequency is low enough, my polonium source is working correctly, I can have an upper polonium source, a lower polonium source, bring the two wires together into an op-amp, and I will measure damn close to the exact same number of volts per meter as if I put a dipole there. But there's a catch. Between the upper and lower polonium source, I hooked up a piece of wire. The presence of the wire going to the polonium source, very similar to the presence of a vertically polarized piece of wire of a vertically polarized dipole in the changing magnetic field by way of Faraday's law is inducing a voltage. Here's the change in the experiment. Rather than being fooled by the wire to the polonium sources creating the problem, I'm now on the upper polonium source. Let me drop.